In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, Paul made this statement. He said, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote." So from that point forward in the scriptures, Paul is now in the section of the letter where he is answering the questions that the church at Corinth had written to him in regards to. He first dealt with their question about Christian sexuality. And he was very thorough in his response because Corinth, very much like America, was a very sexually confused place. And so the Christians living there in Corinth were having a difficult time sorting out what is best for Christians. And so Paul gave them those answers. And we went through that very thoroughly. And we did not have to do that. As I shared with you, we could have buzzed through that. And then I could have just kept referring you back to the 5-part sermon series that we did on these topics, singleness, marriage, divorce, remarriage. But I threw the question out to the congregation and I said, "Do you guys want me to buzz through this or do you want me to go through this slowly?" And in anchored fellowship style and fashion, you guys didn't say a word. Thank you for the help. So I had to make the decision on my own. I made the decision to be thorough. I guess that's a good default mode. When in doubt, be thorough. I am now glad that we did that because we now, as a fellowship, have 9 teachings on the topic of Christian sexuality, which involves the topics of singleness, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. That's going to serve as a good resource as long as this church is still standing or until they take my sermons off of the internet, whatever comes first. But now in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul is answering some questions that the church at Corinth had about diet. And it's not what you think. Surprisingly, it has nothing to do with the Jewish kosher diet that is found in Leviticus chapter 11. Are you familiar with that? For animals, it needs to chew the cud and split the hoof. If it chews the cud but doesn't split the hoof, you can't eat it. I don't know why I'm saying hoof and not hoof. And vice versa, you can't eat it. It's got to do both. It's got to chew the cud and split the hoof. Regarding seafood, it's got to have fins and scales. If it has fins but not scales or scales but not fins, don't eat it. All right, so those are the rules. A very enthralling section of study. To date, our most popular study that's visited online. Clearly, that's a joke. But listen, in those early church days, that was usually the issue. The issue was usually over this. As Christians, what do we do now regarding Leviticus 11 and the laws concerning the kosher Jewish diet? Does a Jewish Christian need to keep on holding to, adhering to the kosher diet? What about Gentile Christians? They weren't even in this thing. They were just pagans and now they got saved. Do they need to observe Leviticus chapter 11, the kosher diet as well? That was usually what the arguments were about in the early church. They had to hash that out on multiple occasions. But that is not Corinth's issue at all. They are past that. Paul has taught them well. He spent a year and a half as their pastor. Apparently he taught them very well that if you are a Christian, doesn't matter what your roots are, if you are Jew or Gentile, if you are a Christian, you no longer have to, for spiritual purposes, maintain a kosher diet. You can eat whatever you want and that is not going to defile you in any way. So that's not the issue. That's not the controversy for the church at Corinth. Not over what type of meat is permissible. Their issue is what has happened to that meat. Namely this, was that meat that you're eating sacrificed to idols? So here's the question that they gave to Paul. Again, we don't have that letter, but we have Paul's responses. So we surmise the question. The question was something like this. As Christians, is it appropriate for us to eat meat that either we know has been sacrificed to false gods or we suspect might have been sacrificed to false gods? So that's the question. And if this sounds like useless information to you this morning, would you please consider that anytime Paul is dealing with the topic of meat, food, meat offered to idols, kosher diet, anytime in Paul's letters that he is dealing with this topic, he also includes with it all of the other non-essentials of the Christian faith. Now, this church, you've been taught this stuff well, so those keywords, that should let you know exactly where we are going with this. He's not, you know, Paul is rarely, when he's talking about this topic, only once, I believe, which is here in 1 Corinthians 8, does he not include all of the other stuff, the non-essentials of the faith, Christian liberties, preferentials, disputable matters, gray areas, opinions, pick your word. Paul usually lumps that all together because the principles that apply to what we eat as Christians and what we drink as Christians, it applies to everything else in that category. Everything else that would be considered a non-essential or a disputable matter. How do we define that? Well, it's simple. If it has been clearly defined by the Bible to be a sin, or if we have been clearly told in the scriptures to avoid something, then that's the line that we draw in the sand. Okay, that's a sin. We're going to avoid that. But anything that is not explicitly stated and clearly communicated to us as a sin or something to avoid, it now falls into this gray area category, non-essential to our faith. I shared with you, I give you my word, you can take this to heaven with you. If there was something that was essential for your salvation, you had better believe the Lord would have told you about it very plainly in here. So if he hasn't told you about it very plainly in here, that means it is not essential to your salvation. Now, that doesn't mean it's not going to have a part in your spirituality. It's going to. And we're going to look at how to fit all of that together, how to work all of that out. But just starting right here, if it's an issue or a matter that the Bible is not clear or decisive on, that means it falls into this broad range of stuff that Paul is dealing with here. These are the same principles. So just always remember that quote that I gave you from Romans 14, because you guys know this topic well. We covered it fairly exhaustively in our study of Romans chapter 14. And remember that quote I gave you there. It just sums this all up. Like, you could take everything Paul teaches on the matter, you could apply this quote to it. It is attributed to Augustine. Word is that when Augustine gave us this quote, he was quoting a feller by the name of Robertus Meldinius. But that quote is simply this: in essentials, unity; in non-essentials, liberty; in all things, charity, which is the English translation for the Greek word agape, which is perfect, willful, unconditional love. The kind of love that Christ has for us. So if you just remember that, or just take my word if you weren't here, and take that from our study of Romans 14, then you're ready to study 1 Corinthians chapter 8 with us this morning. So let's go ahead and get moving. Verse 1, we read, Now concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Now, that is a tricky verse, but the ESV translation really helps us with the understanding here, because notice they put some quotes in here. Those are very important quotes. They have put quotes around the statement, all of us possess knowledge. The ESV is not using that as a quote. It is actually using those quotation marks as what is known as scare quotes in English literary style. And what scare quotes are is that something that you put around an expression or a word or a phrase when you want to express skepticism, irony, or sarcasm about what you're speaking. And that works for air quotes as well. For example, if I said to you this morning, this is going to be a very short sermon, you get my point. You know how I use those air quotes. I've used them as scare quotes, which means I am dubious about the statement that I just made. You're not going to expect a short message. By the way, it shouldn't be that long. Just an example, right? The ESV is right in applying scare quotes here and thereby giving us an interpretation of what Paul is saying. Paul is actually being sarcastic here. Are you surprised? No. We've been studying Paul's sarcasm for quite a while now. Holy sarcasm. Snark, if you prefer. Paul is being snarky about this. So what he's basically saying, once you interpret with the scare quotes, he's saying this: hey, when it comes to food offered to idols, I know, everybody knows everything there is to know about it. Everyone's always right about it. Their interpretation is always the best. You can't tell anyone anything. That's what he's saying here. He's using it in a very sarcastic way. And then Paul also uses those scare quotes again by saying this knowledge puffs up. We know what puffs up means. That means to puff up with pride, to inflate the ego. So he's saying this quote unquote knowledge puffs up with pride. Now, Paul would never say that ever about true biblical knowledge. He would never say that. Trust me. Because when it comes to true biblical knowledge, that includes the stuff that keeps us humble, doesn't it? That's all in true biblical knowledge. If you have true biblical knowledge, you're not going to be puffed up with pride. He's not talking about biblical knowledge here, or knowledge for knowledge's sake. He's talking about so-called knowledge. In other words, he's saying, you know, these are Christian know-it-alls. That's what he's calling them here, essentially. Christian know-it-alls. You all know everything that there is to know about this, but maybe you don't know it all like you think you do. Now, with that in mind, and only with that interpretation, this verse now makes really good and easy sense. That when it comes to eating meat that was offered to an idol, or by extrapolation, taking the principles and extrapolating that out to other non-essentials of the faith, preferentials, opinions, disputable matters, gray areas, that when it comes to these things, if we let our so-called knowledge take the lead on these issues, then all that's going to accomplish is brother inflated with pride against another brother. It's just going to produce Christians that are egotistical, arrogant, and prideful against one another as they dispute these issues out. What's the alternative to letting knowledge, so-called knowledge, lead us in regards to non-essentials, or in this case specifically the eating of meat sacrificed to idols? So what's the alternative? Paul gave it to us. It's love, agape. So we have our choice here. When we get to disputable matters, we can let our knowledge lead us. And if we do that, if we let our knowledge lead us, that's going to blow us up. But if we let love lead us, then that's going to build us up. So there's a clear winner there. Now, that is not always the way that we handle disputes within the church, is it? This is only going to be the way that we handle matters in reference to the non-biblical stuff, the stuff that the Bible has not clearly drawn a line in the sand for, right? Now, if it comes to biblical stuff, what are we going to let lead in that case? If the Lord has given us a clear definition of sin, if the Lord has demonstrably told us to avoid something, how are we going to handle that? Are we going to let love lead in that case, or are we going to let knowledge lead in that case? Here's a good example for you. Someone's been attending our fellowship for a while, and they say, you know, I feel called into the ministry. I would like to be a support pastor here at Anchored Fellowship. Would you ordain me as a pastor and let me help you with the work? I believe just like you guys at Anchored Fellowship. Well, there is that one exception. I do believe in polygamy. I do have four wives. Is that going to be a problem? Yeah, that's going to be a problem. You can see why we can't let love lead there, right? At least not love as the world would define it. Because if we're letting love lead in that case, we're going to say, oh, well, yeah, we do see differently there. But man, we love you. We don't want to lose you. We don't want you, you know, going to the church down the street. We want you to stay here. We want to support you in your different interpretation of the scriptures. You see why we can't let love lead in that case, right? We have to let knowledge lead in that case. We're going to take that dude to 1 Timothy chapter 3. We're going to say the qualifications for an elder or a deacon is that you must be the husband of one wife, just one, only one. That's what that means. So, yes, there are biblical cases where we need to let our knowledge lead us, but in a situation like this, when these are disputable matters, things that aren't real clear to us in the scriptures, then we're going to have to let love take the lead on those occasions. Reading on. Verse 2. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. So according to Paul, anytime that you are just certain that your approach on a non-essential Christian matter is the approach that everyone else should take, you're just sure that you're the authoritative source for that decision, you're just positive that your scriptural arguments are the absolute best, and that there's no other way to view that, and there's no other possibility that a Christian might genuinely be better off going in another direction regarding that non-essential. Anytime you think that, then all that you're proving is that you are, according to verse 2, but in my own words, a Christian know-it-all that doesn't know it all. That's exactly what you are. This statement demands that we no longer look at Christian liberties in terms of black and white, but that we first begin all Christian liberties in the gray area. And then we see what they do for each person individually. So, when it comes to Christian liberties, what's best for me and my spirituality may not always be what's best for you and your spirituality. Again, if the Bible has called it a sin, it's a sin. We stick with that. But if it's in a gray area, we begin it with the gray area. We begin it as neutral. And then we realize that even as a liberty, even as a neutral, it can still become sin to us. So we have to approach this from an individual basis. And each one of us has to seek the Lord and study the scriptures and find out what's going to support them best in their own Christian development. So, Lord, Arlen says this is the way he approaches this Christian liberty. How do you want me to do it? What's best for him may not be best for me. So this verse kind of forces us to make that acknowledgement. Verse 3, but if anyone loves God, he is known by God. Okay, that is a simple enough verse to understand if it were a standalone statement. But it's not a standalone statement, is it? Context, context, context. There's a context to this. We're following a context. So when we put this in context of what we're studying, for example, if we just combine verse 2 with this, it would look something like this, again in my own words. Verse 2, if you think you know what's best for everyone on topics that the Bible hasn't addressed, then you don't know as much as you think you do. And then verse 3, God knows who really loves him. That's what he's saying. That's exactly what he's saying. I guess that's a kind way of saying, back off and let God be the God of that person. Let God direct them. And that goes hand in hand with what Paul taught us in Romans chapter 14, verse 4, when Paul said, who do you think you are to judge another man's servant? To his master, he stands or falls. And he will stand because the Lord is able to make him stand. In other words, that's not your servant that you're trying to boss around. That's not your servant that you're trying to dictate how they are to handle their Christian liberties. That's God's servant. That's God's responsibility. And you ought, as a wise individual, to keep your hands out of those types of matters and just let the Lord be the Lord. Verse 4. Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one. Okay, you're seeing a bunch of quotes again here, but both of these quotes in verse 4, those aren't scare quotes anymore. These are actual quotes. These are in reference to Old Testament quotes. We'll get to those in just a moment. Old Testament and New Testament quotes, but we'll get to those in just a moment. Verse 5, for although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, and what that means is not that there are many gods or multiple gods in heaven or on earth. He says so-called gods here, so what that means is that this is what the pagans believe. The pagans believe that there are gods in heaven and gods living here on the earth. That's what they believe. It's not true, but that's what they believe. And he goes on to say, as indeed there are many gods, there's the scare quotes, many gods and many lords. There's scare quotes again. So, yeah, gods, wink. Lords, wink. Good translation. I like that. So Paul would be talking about the pagan viewpoint there. Those who worship false gods, yes, they believe there are many gods, some who dwell in heaven, some who dwell on the earth with them. That's not what Christians believe. And Paul is not giving any credence to the viewpoint that there actually are many gods and many lords. He has already defined for us what Christians believe, aka the truth, in verse 4, that there is no God but Jehovah. There's one true God. Verse 6, yet for us, so here's what we Christians believe, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and from whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we exist. Now, before we get moving too far, let me give you a quick breakdown of what food sacrificed to idols would look like at this time in this culture. The idea of animal sacrifice to the gods, that was not exclusive to Judaism. In fact, history would say that that probably did not even begin with Judaism. In fact, nearly every pagan religion has, or at least these early pagan religions, has embraced some form of animal sacrifice to their gods. Some human sacrifice, but that's outside the scope of our teaching for today. In the first century AD, Roman Gentiles were no different. They were polytheists. They believed in many gods, and they sacrificed to those gods. They brought animals. Those animals were slain on altars, very, very much like Judaism, very similar to it. And they would bring with those sacrifices their prayers, whatever they were praying for, financial success, marital bliss, praying for a child, praying for blessing on a home. And this is pagan religion, so that included praying curses on people. Anything they were praying for, they'd bring that animal sacrifice to their God. They'd sacrifice it in hopes that their God would grant them their prayer request and answer that, you know, according to the need that they had expressed. Now, at this time and in this place, in Corinth, polytheism was a big thing. It was very prevalent. There were many gods, many temples, many altars, and so there were many sacrifices going on a daily basis. And it worked similar to the way that it worked in Judaism, where you would bring a sacrifice, you'd sacrifice that animal on the altar, that God would get some of the portions of that animal that you were sacrificing. You'd burn that up on the altar for that God. But then the bringer of that offering, the offerer, would get the majority of that meat from that animal, and they would be able to eat that meat. Problem is, I mean, you've seen how big a cow is, right? What do you do if you've just killed a cow and you can eat it, but you don't have a refrigerator? You're scarfing down, and you want help. That's a lot of meat. So what ended up happening was that there was so much meat that was being turned out of these pagan temples that could not be eaten by the offerers, and what they would do is they would bring it to the agora, that is the marketplace there. Think of like Fayette County food booths. You know, it's a bunch of booths, this marketplace area where you walk through and there's all these booths where you can buy stuff. They would take this meat and they would give it to the booths, and the booths would sell it there in the marketplace at very steeply discounted prices. Because they had so much meat and they had to move it because of, you know, preservation concerns. And that's where the rub began for the Corinthian Christians. It's the issue of value shopping. Now, you can get your holy meat that hasn't been infected with any pagan cooties. You can get that, but there may not be as much available. The best cuts may not be available. First come, first serve. Not as big of a market in this location. And you're going to pay a premium. You're going to pay the full price for quote-unquote holy meat. See, I did scare quotes again. But if you go to the agora, if you go to the pagan marketplaces, you can get the best cuts of meat. Filet mignon, you want it? It's there. Sirloin, you want it? It's there. Ribeye, you want it? It's there. And the best part is incredible discounts. You're going to save a lot of money. So here's the rub. Is it okay as a Corinthian Christian for us to go and you know, skip the expensive holy stuff, go straight to the pagan marketplaces, get really good cuts of meat, knowing that it is more than likely sacrificed to an idol, and when you get it home, you're eating Jupiter steaks and Mars burgers. Is that okay for me? Can I do that? Or should I avoid that? Now, I realize it's not really a preeminent issue in the United States, but that's not to say it's a non-existent issue. We technically still do have a similar thing taking place. Here's just one example. Halal food. Have you ever seen a halal sticker on a package of food? All right, there's halal food in this country. And if you see that sticker on it, halal, do you know what that means? That means that it was either harvested or butchered in accordance with Muslim law. And in order to do that, to harvest or butcher in accordance with Muslim law, it would have to have the Bismillah prayed over it, which means you take that meat as you're harvesting it or butchering it, and you say, in the name of Allah. Okay? Now, if you go to Walmart right now, there are 219 products online that you can buy, food products, that are halal, which means, according to Muslim law, they were harvested and dedicated to Allah. Now, we Christians believe that Allah is a false god. So, you may even have some halal products in your cupboards at home. Heathens. Sinners. How could you not check for that? Now, admit, you see the issue here. Admit, it makes you want to go home and check your cupboards, doesn't it? My first instinct is, I'm not buying that. Are you kidding me? That's my first instinct. I love the Lord. I don't want to even get close to iffy and shady stuff. And I think you're the same way. You have the same heart as me in that regard. So what do you do? What do you do as a Christian? Surely it must be more spiritual to avoid food, excuse me, that has some kind of connection to idolatry and a false god, right? Surely it must be more spiritual to avoid that, right? Wrong. Exactly wrong. Now, it's not more spiritual the other way. It's just a neutral thing. That's what Paul is going to teach us. Verse 4, verse 5, verse 6. Those verses anchor us to the truth that there is only one God. All right, here's the argument, and it has to be the argument. If this is not the argument, then Paul's got nothing. Here's the argument. Verses 4, 5, and 6 anchor us to the truth that there is only one God. That's the God that we serve. And that all other gods are false gods. They're not gods at all. So we have nothing to be worried about. Now, Paul is not claiming that there is no sentience, sapience, or no power behind a false god or behind an idol. He's not claiming that. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament teach us that indeed sentience, sapience, power, legitimate being, is behind idols and false gods, for sure. It's just that we call them demons. When people worship any god but Yahweh, they're not worshiping other gods. It's not good enough just to admit that they're lesser gods. They're not worshiping other gods. They're worshiping demons. So yes, there is a response there. You want to ask the question, why would you worship demons when our God's real and he actually does stuff? Well, it's because their gods do stuff too. Again, there's sentience there. There's sapience there. There's power there. There's being there. So you can pray to a false god and there can be response. There can be power affected. Your prayers can be legitimately answered by that thing you prayed to, even if it was a statue of wood. Because there's a demon behind it, and a demon does have power. We're told in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 17, they sacrificed to demons that were no gods. And then Paul is going to get back to this subject in just two chapters. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 19 and 20, he's going to say, what do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice they offer to demons and not to God. So according to Paul, it's not that there's no being behind the idols. It's just that they're nothing. Why are they nothing? Because they're not God. so I can have my Mars burgers and my Jupiter steak. And the reason I can do that is because the moment that I take it, even if it's got the halal sticker on it, the moment I take it, it's no longer Allah's or Jupiter's or Mars. It's mine in the name of my God who breaks curses. I don't care what they did with that food. They could curse it if they wanted to, as they offered it and sacrificed it, as they put their sticker on it to make it kosher for their religion. I don't care what they did to it. When I take it, that all changes because that is now for my purposes and my body is for the Lord's purposes. That's God's. And He's going to bring all of that to naught. Isn't that wonderful? Now, before we read on, verse 6 is as clear a statement of the deity of Jesus as there is in the Bible, and yet some people won't see it there because even though they're getting the same treatment, God the Father, God the Son, even though they're getting the same treatment, theos is used for God the Father, and kurios is used for Jesus the Son. Theos means deity, and kurios means supreme leader. So they see God, and then they see Lord, and they think, okay, well, Jesus is getting a lesser title. Well, it is a different title for sure, but it is still that same lofty position of supreme ruler. You got God, deity, you got Lord, kurios. And if that trips you up, just look at how they're handled. Father and Son, both the same. Check that out. We were created by God the Father. Oh, we were also created by Jesus the Son. And we were created for God the Father. Oh, and by the way, also, we were created for Jesus the Son. So it's a good statement of deity. You can mark that down in your little Bible knowledge book that you have beside your Bible. Verse 7, however, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Defiled means, you know, made dirty, made filthy. So once again, it's not what most people would think it would be when it comes to religious convictions. I think we're sort of trained, if you've grown up in a church, you're sort of trained to believe that the strictest people, the most restrictive people, the most legalistic people, well, aren't they just by default going to be the most holy people? And the answer is no. That's the exact opposite. Paul always consistently maintains that it's the other way around, that it's never the Christian who embraces their liberties, or at least understands their liberties, whether they embrace them or not, that Paul calls the weaker Christian. It is always the Christian who has the overly strong convictions and consciences that Paul will call the weaker brothers and sisters in Christ. Now, he still puts them in Christ, which is encouraging. But there's that acknowledgement. They're weaker in the faith because they have weak consciences on matters. They're getting all bent out of shape, out of stuff they shouldn't be getting bent out of shape over. They have made rules and erected walls where God did not. So their conscience is even stricter than God would have it to be. That's a problem. But in verse 7, we have really the reason why someone would be stricter in their convictions and consciences. And to be honest, it makes perfect sense. And knowing this is helpful to the stronger Christians that have to deal with the other Christians who are just constantly bothered by something and calling everything sin. This is actually really helpful to know this stuff. So I hope that you'll pay close attention to it. Usually, all of this stems from our backgrounds. I mean, just listen to the argumentation that Paul has just made here. A Christian who used to sacrifice animals to pagan gods, what's going to happen to them? They are going to be naturally more sensitive to anything that involves pagan worship. Naturally, doesn't that make sense? They want complete disconnection from that. Why? Because that's one of the things that God delivered them from. That's part of their past. And they're having a difficult time making that disconnect if other Christians around them are skirting a little bit too close to what they feel like they've been delivered from. It makes sense, doesn't it? I hope it does, because It's going to work that way with everything else. Everything else that falls into issues that are non-essential to our salvation, it's gonna be the exact same way. Just let me buzz through some examples real quick. A person that's been delivered from drunkenness, they are going to be against the Christian liberty of drinking alcohol. Now, it is clearly given to us in the Bible as a Christian liberty, one that we cannot judge one another over. Paul said that outright. Try to get around that. Somehow Christians still do, okay? It's a liberty, legit liberty, and yet that Christian that's been delivered from alcoholism, drunkenness, they're going to want nothing to do with Christians who teach that it's okay for Christians to drink alcohol. A saved stripper. I know this is a weird example, but a saved stripper might have a difficulty with Christians who dance. They might think that that's always wrong, that that's always a sin. I say it's only a sin if the Christians really can't dance. You got to watch them. You got to see how they do. That's not a reused joke, by the way. That's a refurbished joke. I took that joke out of Romans 14, but I reworked it and made it a little different. Yeah, they may have a problem with that. Even though the Bible would support Christians dancing appropriately as a Christian liberty, yet they once used dancing for very different purposes, seductive purposes, sinful purposes, and they may struggle with that. There's just that difficulty making that disconnect there. A person delivered from the occult, they might get really bent out of shape that you celebrate Halloween, and you may say, well, listen, I only dress as John the Baptist and Peter the Apostle. Keep sticking my foot in my mouth. It's a great costume. You know, you may dress up as neutral or saintly things, and that's good for you. You like that because you're trying to redeem the holiday. But the person that's been saved out of the occultist, they're like, why are you messing with that? That stuff's real. There's real power behind that. There's evil. That's evil stuff. Why are you messing with evil? So you see, there's the sympathy for understanding that a lot of times background dictates where our consciences are sensitive and sometimes overly sensitive. Kind of immediately we're calling for understanding when it comes to the sensitivities of our consciences, right? None of us want to go back to the things that God has delivered us from. That's proper for us as Christians. So our consciences will be sensitive and sometimes oversensitive in the things, the dark things of the past that we were once closely connected to. We need to understand that about each other. Verse 8. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. Now, you might want to hang that verse above your kitchen table so that you can quote it at times. I won't be any worse off if I eat this whole pizza. That's a great verse. I love empowering verses like that. No, that's not what that means. I'm joking, of course. He is not talking about benefit to physical health. He's not talking about physical well-being here. He's only talking about the implications upon us spiritually and what is proper for our spiritual well-being. The only time that food could possibly affect your spiritual well-being in any way is if you're fasting food, because you're fasting for spiritual purposes. That's it. But other than that, food is always going to be one of those neutral things. You can't like have a diet that makes you more holy or a diet that makes you less holy. Again, it's not talking about physical health. Obviously, if your diet was nothing but Krispy Kreme donuts and Monster energy drinks, yes, that's, you're worse off than the person that has the healthy diet, and you're probably going to die young. But in spiritual terms, the Krispy Kreme Monster guy is no worse off than the guy with the perfect healthy diet. Verse 9. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. So Paul is perfectly consistent every time he talks on matters of Christian liberties. He always puts the responsibility of properly handling the situation on the stronger believers, on the people who are stronger in their faith. They're more comfortable with their Christian liberties. They know them, whether they exercise them or not. They're just more mature and more grown up in those areas. He never puts the responsibility on the weaker Christians to step up, get with the program, and get it right, does he? That's so loving. I tell you, if Paul did not come across these revelations on how to handle these issues, I would have never found it. My approach would have been very different. Paul's is a very loving approach. As I shared with you in Romans chapter 14, that is because they are weaker Christians. You don't put more responsibility on weaker Christians. You put the more responsibility on the stronger Christians because they're more likely to handle it. You know, you're climbing a mountain with some buddies. You got an additional burden that you need to get to the top of the mountain. Who are you going to give the burden to? You can give that extra burden to the weaker climber? I think not. Or are you going to give it to the stronger climber? Yeah, that makes more sense. So we're going to do the same thing in spiritual terms here regarding these matters. Verse 10. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, emboldened, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? Verse 11. And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Verse 12. Thus sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Verse 10, verse 11, very important verses for us here in consideration of our topic of study. Paul has identified the dangers that are present for both sides of this argument, for both sides of this position on matters of non-biblicals, non-essentials, disputable matters in gray areas. For those who have an overactive conscience, what's the danger? Is it a sin to have an overactive conscience? No, it's not a sin to have an overactive or overly sensitive conscience. That's not the danger for the person in that situation. The danger would be if you violate your overly sensitive and overly active conscience. That's the danger. Now, I would take us to Romans chapter 14, verse 23 for this, because Paul put it just real plain and clear here. He said in that verse, whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats. Remember, this goes for everything. Is a Christian allowed to dance? Well, Arlen's just convinced. He showed me good scriptural support, so I'm going to go dance. All right, if you're not convinced when you do it, you're condemned. Because the eating is not from faith. The dancing is not from faith. The drinking is not from faith. What you're wearing, the clothes you're wearing, they're not from faith. For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. So, if you were a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and then you got saved. Oh, pardon me. Freudian slip. If you're a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and then you started attending a more fundamental Christian church, yes, we're going to be able to convince you that it is not a sin to worship the Lord on Sunday. It's so absurd to me that there could be a teaching like that, like God would keep you out of heaven. I mean, you know, I've shared this with you before. The Seventh-day Adventists teach that worshiping on Sunday is the mark of the beast. It means it's unpardonable. It's an unpardonable sin. If you worship the Lord on Sunday, that's an unpardonable sin. You're going to hell. Why would God send us to hell for worshiping on one day over another? The whole premise for the positional stance is ludicrous to me, but nonetheless, if we convince you, the former Seventh-day Adventist, that no, of course it's not a sin to worship on Sunday. Of course not. The apostles, they worshiped on Sunday as a celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ on the first day of the week, Sunday. Not the Sabbath, the seventh day of the week. Well, we could convince you of that intellectually, like you could see it. Okay, yeah, I you're right. I see the verses. But as I share with you in our Romans 14 study, not always is what you know and what you feel and believe on the same page. Your conscience does not always immediately catch up with your knowledge. Sometimes you get things first up here in your knowledge or in your mind, and yet your conscience lags behind and it still bothers you over stuff that you know mentally is not a sin for you. And if you're pushing past that stuff, the Bible says that's a sin for you. That's a sin. And the reason why it's a sin, even though it's a rule that the Lord didn't make that you're breaking, even though it's a wall that the Lord didn't build that you're busting through, the reason it's a sin is because you believe it's wrong. You believe it's a sin. You believe the Lord is displeased with it, offended by it, maybe even perhaps ready to damn over it, and yet you're still doing it anyway. You're pushing past, and that is an act of rebellion. And it's something God never wants to see on his kids. Even if it's a rebellion against a false, erroneous belief, an overly active and oversensitive conscience, it's still rebellion, and the Lord doesn't want to see his people in that state. And again, the real danger there is that as you keep overstepping the boundaries of your conscience and sinning against your conscience, what ends up happening is your conscience eventually loses all of its sensitivity. And you end up with what is called in the scriptures a defiled conscience. That means you get to the point where nothing seems wrong to you. Nothing seems like a sin to you, and that's a big problem. So that's the issue for the person that has the overly sensitive or overly active conscience. What's the issue? What's the warning? What's the problem for the person that actually is accurate? They're right about this. Whatever this disputable matter is, they're right about it. They have the right stance. They are not bothered in their conscience by it. They're in a perfectly good situation. The Lord's not displeased at all with how they are handling that liberty or that non-essential. What's the danger for a person like that? It's all given to us in verse 10 and 11. The danger is that even though you're right, and it's not a sin to be right, thank goodness, some of y'all be in a lot of trouble because you're always right. It's not a sin to be right. Right, wives? It's not a sin to be right. What's the sin? The sin is when you know you're right and then you coerce another brother or sister who's having a struggle there. They haven't been able to make that disconnect yet, or they haven't been able to get their consciences on board with their knowledge. You're coercing them to do something that defiles their conscience. They're sinning against their conscience, which is sinning against Christ, according to Romans chapter 14, verse 23. And now what have you done? You have committed a sin. You've caused another brother to stumble. Verse 13. Therefore, if food makes my brother to stumble. Man, I hate to read this next part. This is tough. Spirit, help me. Lord, help me. We really missed our timing on this one, didn't we? This study, perfect for next week. Talking about food, getting y'all hungry, then throwing you downstairs for food, that's perfect. The smell of meat, that would probably aid in a study of this chapter here. Instead, next week, you know, well, no food talk. And this week, really unfortunate, all this food talk, and then I got to send you away hungry. What can I say? Just drive really fast, as long as you don't go over the speed limit. What do you expect me to say? I'm a pastor. All right, let's finish it up. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. So I want you to see this. If our so-called knowledge is leading the way on this, we will never arrive at the conclusion of verse 13. Here's where we'll arrive. No, I'm right. And you're wrong. My argument is stronger biblically. I can support it. Yours is weaker. I'm right. That's where we'll arrive. If knowledge is leading this, we will only arrive here to this conclusion, verse 13, the same conclusion as Paul. That will only become obvious to us if love is leading the way in regard to the non-essentials and disputable matters of the faith. If love is the be-all, end-all in all of these matters, then that is the only reasonable conclusion that you'll reach. Verse 13. If something is going to stumble another believer, then I'm just going to give it up. If you're offended by blue shirts, okay, I know all my shirts are blue. You might need to give me a few weeks to recover. See if I can sell some of these on eBay. I'm giving up my blue shirts. Because your souls and your spiritual health, that is more important than any of the liberties that I may be enjoying here on this earth. It's just earthly stuff. The spiritual stuff, the eternal stuff, that's far more important. I'll close with this. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the famous Baptist preacher from the 19th century, he was known to enjoy cigars, and he was dogmatic that it was not a sin to him. And he's right. You're not going to find in the Bible Thou shalt not smoketh thine cigars, okay, or thine cigarettes. No, you're not going to find that. It has to be a disputable matter. Do you agree? Okay, that's true. So he's right. It is a liberty, and it was a liberty that he loved. He used to argue with his other preacher buddies. They would go back and forth on that. And what changed Charles Spurgeon's mind, because he would not back down on this. He would not give up on this. He would, in fact, light up sometimes in front of people that he knew it was going to antagonize and flaunt his liberty, which is everything Paul's teaching us not to do in First Corinthians chapter 8 and also Romans chapter 14. So what really finally got Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers, so-called, I love the scare quotes. We're just going to keep using those. What finally got him was one day, he saw publicly an advertisement for a brand of cigars. And here's what the advertisement said. It said, the cigar of choice for Charles Spurgeon. And when he saw that, when he saw the public use of his name to promote cigars, that disturbed him. Because in that moment, he realized that his personal liberty was now being used to influence others and potentially leading them into a habit they might not have the maturity or the conviction to handle wisely. So that led him to give up cigars. That's when he finally gave up cigars. Not because he believed they were a sin. No one convinced him of that. But simply because he didn't want to become a stumbling block to other brothers and sisters. In other words, he finally got it. He finally understood what Paul was teaching here.